Hello, everyone, and welcome to I Eat Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I'm so happy to be here with you for the next hour. I have a wonderful guest joining me later today. Her name's Carlene Madigan, and she is the author of this wonderful book called The Backyard Homestead. And I'll be asking her all about the garden in just a little bit. But first, I want to just share with you what's going on in my world and find out what's going on in your world. The garden is blooming. It's, you know, it's in full swing now. There's no turning back. You know, I am harvesting just about everything. The tomatoes are so big, they look like pumpkins. I have beautiful, gorgeous tomatoes. I'm doing green zebra tomatoes this year for the first time. And there's another type of tomato I'm growing that I'm actually not even sure of the name. It's yellow and red together, and it's, you know, multicolor. If you get my emails, I actually put it on my newsletter this week because it was so beautiful. So we have tomatoes galore, we have arugula, we have cucumbers, and I think I mentioned last week that I'm growing these blonde cucumbers this year as well as the more traditional cucumbers. And the blonde cucumbers are yellow on the outside, this deep orchid yellow. And it's just, they're beautiful, they're delicious, and there's so many of them. I'm actually pickling them. I pulled out Sandra Katz's book on the art of fermentation, and he will be my guest, you know, in a few weeks. And so I thought I would try out doing some of his pickling, and so far they're tasting great. So they still have some more to go, but they're really doing wonderful. And what else am I harvesting? My eggplants, which I talked to you all about at the beginning of the month, that were really struggling, actually last month, are really starting to grow now. Very exciting. My peppers are finally growing. I have some jalapeno peppers already. My zucchinis, my summer squash are doing well. I had a kombucha squash last week in my cooking class. We actually cooked up the first harvested kombucha squash from my garden, and oh, it was delicious. And that's a great recipe I'll share with you sometime. Roasting it in the oven and, you know, little cubes, and then sauteing it on the stovetop. Really good. What else? My potatoes are doing wonderful. I'm growing these little fingerling potatoes. I'm excited about that. My peach tree is still hurting. Oh, I hope maybe later on when I'm speaking to Carlene, she'll know something about peach trees. But those borers are in the trunks, and the sap is just oozing out of the branches of the peach tree, and it just makes me cry looking at it. I just don't know what to do. And many of the peaches are going bad. I think some of them might still work. They're still growing, and they're looking beautiful, the ones that are still looking beautiful. So I'm hoping I can harvest them before I lose my tree. What else? Blueberries are getting ready. My raspberries are getting ready. What else am I harvesting right now? Lettuce, of course, is still going. I just planted a new crop of dill and cilantro, and those are coming in. My parsley I've just about used up. I need to plant more. I find one of the biggest challenges is to get that, you know, that rhythm going where you leave enough open space to plant more, you know, succession planting. So in anticipation of some space opening up, I started some seedlings in the greenhouse, and I'm also now learning about greenhouses. You can't leave seedlings in a greenhouse in this heat. I unfortunately killed them. So live and learn. We are learning. I will plant them again. My interns are learning as well, along with me. So it's all fun. It's all exciting. And we're just having a great time. I started my cooking series. Last Thursday was my first cooking class. It was a vegan cooking class, and it was wonderful. We had there were only 5 people in the class, plus myself and my helpers. There were 7 of us. But it was a really great class, and everyone got a lot of, you know, hands-on time. And tomorrow's class is much more crowded. It's actually full. It's the raw class, and there's 12 of us, plus there's, you know, two other people that are going to be just watching. So it's a full class, but it's really exciting. You know, I have a guest chef that's going to join me, Okima, who runs the Live Island Cafe out in Huntington. And she definitely has more experience cooking raw than I do, although I've been really having a wonderful time learning more about it and experimenting with it. So we have a wonderful menu planned. We're going to make green gazpacho soup with cilantro. We're going to make raw lasagna, we call it, layered zucchini lasagna. We are going to make prosciutto, and she is making some hasin bread that she'll bring with us that she will use to dehydrate. But she's actually going to bring her dehydrator here so we can see it in action and work with it, which will be my first time. I have not worked with a dehydrator before, so looking forward to that. And we're going to do a zucchini pesto, and we're going to make a chocolate ganache dessert along with a lemon-lime cheesecake tart with raspberries. So we have a really full menu planned, and that will be wonderful. I have two more classes coming up the end of August, the 23rd and the 30th, and there's still room in those classes if anyone is interested. You can register on my website at iegreen.com. Go to the event page, and there's a PayPal link right there. So you can register there or on my Facebook page. And what else is going on? This weekend was great. This weekend I did two different demos. On Saturday I was at the Gateway Community Gardens, which is a community garden that my local Slow Food chapter, Slow Food Huntington, worked alongside the Long Island Community Action Network, or Community Agricultural Network, Long Island CAN. And we started this community garden in an area that is right next to the projects, not in the great area in South Huntington or in Huntington Station. And the year prior to the community garden getting started, there was a shooting there. It was a hangout spot, lots of drugs. And now it's been, you know, the trees have been taken away. It's been cleared. They have, you know, like 40-something raised beds. They have raised beds also for handicap and elderly people. There's also a children's garden. It's just a really happening place, and it's really bringing the community together. And originally the town was giving us the space only for a couple of years, but I think at this point there's no way they're moving that garden. It is a real center for the community. And so they had a community day selling some of the vegetables from the garden to try to raise some funds. So I was out there doing a demo. I made some pesto and showed how to make a balsamic vinaigrette and a Japanese ginger dressing. And so that was a lot of fun. And then the following day, on Sunday, I was at the Roosevelt Farmers Market, which is a youth farmers market that was started with a grant from Sustainable Long Island. And it's one of the farmers markets that was trying to address a neighborhood that did not have access to high-quality produce. And so this farmers market got started. They employed some high school students along with some unemployed vets to do the driving, and it's really a beautiful thing. They're there every Sunday, and the prices are right, and it's a really wonderful, energetic place. So I was really happy to be there, and I did a demo sauteing some tofu with all the different vegetables that I got from the garden. And I brought some whole wheat noodles with me and made a tahini dressing for the stir fry, just showing some of the people there, you know, different ways that you could prepare the vegetables that were right there at hand so that they can get more comfortable cooking for themselves with those vegetables that they might not be so familiar with. So there was a lot of different vegetables at the garden. We had some collard greens, we had some kale, of course we had onion, we had carrots. I brought a few portobellos with me just to brighten it up. And of course there was some summer squash and some zucchini. So it was really a wonderful, wonderful event. And tonight, right after this show, I have a kids' cooking class right at my home, also a farm-to-table kids' cooking class. And these kids are going to come, and they're going to each make their own little individual birthday cupcake, a strawberry shortcake cupcake. And they're going to make individual whole wheat pizzas, and they can pick their own toppings. And they're going to go out into the garden and harvest their salad greens. So that will be fun to do as well. So anyway, let me share with you all this recipe that I have for this week. It's the summer greens and feta pie. And it's a take. It's my take on a spinach pie or a spanakopita, which is great to use spinach. But at this time of year, you know, my spinach is finished. Spinach, you know, does not like the heat. So, you know, that's one of my early crops, and then I'll plant it again for the fall. So I was like, okay, well, I have so much Mizuna greens and Swiss chard. Let's use that. So I used Swiss chard, Mizuna greens, collards, kale, really any greens that you have growing in your garden. And you need about 3 pounds of it. So that's a lot of greens. But you need a lot. This is for, to make a full chafing tray size, which is always the size I make because, one, the phyllo pastry comes in a pound box that is, you know, the perfect size for making one full tray of spinach pie. So you get about 20 pieces of phyllo pastry in one of those boxes. And they're just a little bit too wide for the chafing pan, so I just cut the edge off because they're also just a little bit too short, of course. So I cut along the long edge of the phyllo pastry so that I can use that to fill in the shortage up at the top of the chafing pan. So you have one package of phyllo pastry, 3 pounds of the summer greens and a whole combination. I use 2 pounds of feta cheese that I crumble up, and I use about a half a pound of mozzarella. You can leave that out if you don't want to put the mozzarella in, but it's just nice. Sometimes I even put in a little Gruyere cheese, depending on how, you know, depending on who it's for, really. The Gruyere is a little bit more of a grown-up taste, and so if I'm making this for a lot of kids, I stick with the feta and the mozzarella. So you need one bunch of dill as well that you can chop, one onion chopped, and you can saute that ahead of time in some olive oil, 2 eggs that are beaten, 3 handfuls of organic white rice. And you can't use brown rice, unfortunately. Well, I guess you could if you cooked it for a little bit longer, but the brown rice, when I tried using it, it didn't cook all the way. So the white rice, putting it in raw, is wonderful because it absorbs any of the moisture that's still in the greens after, you know, while they're cooking. And it keeps the pastry from being soggy. So it's a great little trick. You're going to use a half a cup of butter, which is one stick of butter, and a half a cup of olive oil. And you're going to melt the butter in a saucepan with the half a cup of olive oil. So the first thing you want to do is you want to remove any large center ribs from the leaves of the kale or the collards because those are tough. So you want to cut those out, and then you're going to blanch all of the greens in some boiling water. And you can put a little salt in that water if you'd like, but you don't need to. There certainly will be enough salt in this dish with the feta cheese. So you just blanch it, meaning that you put it into the boiling water just enough so that it wilts and gets soft. Then take it out and submerge it into a bowl of ice water just to stop the cooking. And then you're going to squeeze out all of the water from the greens. And I literally, you know, just take the greens and squeeze them between my hands to get all the water out. So, you know, you first can drain it in a colander, but then you really have to squeeze it. And then when I squeeze it, the greens are all like in one long log almost. And then I chop it. And I chop it about, you know, into inch pieces. And then I crumble I put it into a bowl, and I crumble the feta cheese in there with it. I add the bunch of chopped dill. And you want a big bunch of chopped dill. A lot of fresh dill is really great in this recipe. If it's a really little skimpy bunch, or if it's one of those cello packs, I wouldn't even buy the cello pack. I mean, that's just so little. You would need like five of them to get enough dill. So you want a really nice bunch of dill that you can get at a fresh produce market. Then you're going to add the sautéed onions. You're going to add the mozzarella cheese. You're going to add the two beaten eggs. And then you're going to add three handfuls of organic white rice. Just mix that mixture really well and have that waiting. When you start with the phyllo pastry, you want to really move rapidly because it can dry out and then it becomes really hard to work with. Phyllo Factory is a wonderful brand of phyllo pastry that they have come out with, and they actually make it organic, and it's great. And I have a lot less problems with it. The brand I used to get before I knew to look at all the ingredients was Athena, I believe it's called, and there's actually a preservative in there. So if you can avoid getting that phyllo pastry, you want to do that. So Phyllo Factory pastry is great. I know they sell it in the freezer section at Whole Foods. And you would need to defrost it first, obviously, either 2 hours on the counter or overnight in the refrigerator. Once you open it up, you're going to move through it quickly. The package might tell you to put a moist dish towel on top of it, but I don't recommend doing that. I find when I do that, sometimes it gets too soggy and the pieces start sticking together. So I just work quickly. I first spray the bottom of my chafing pan, and I put one piece of phyllo pastry down. And then you're going to need a pastry brush for that. And I actually use a paintbrush that's about 3 inches wide, so I can cover a lot of territory at one swipe. And you're just going to brush the phyllo pastry lightly with the butter olive oil mixture. Put another sheet of phyllo on, and you're going to do that for about 10 times. Like I said, there's about 20 sheets of the phyllo pastry in there, so you're going to put 10 on the bottom and 10 on the top. And so you just keep layering it, and as I said, I've cut the little strip off the side, so I put the one large piece in, and then I put that thin strip on the end because it's just a little too short. And I continue doing that for 10 pieces. Then I put the green mixture in there, the green mixture with the feta cheese, and just try to smooth it out so that you don't want to you don't have to press it down really hard, but you want to make it even. And then you're going to put another piece of phyllo pastry right on top of all those greens, brush it with the butter olive oil mixture, another piece down, brush it, and continue until you've used up all of the pastry. Then, this is a really great trick. If you cut the squares before you bake it, it really will help the cutting and the serving of the pastry when it's ready. If you cook it all without scoring it first, cutting through the phyllo pastry just all crumbles. So this is a really worthwhile thing. I cut my pastry, if I have a chafing pan, I start by cutting down the middle, and then I cut each half again down the middle so that I have four long pieces going down the length of the chafing pan. Then I cut again in the middle, and then I cut each of those halves in half, and then I cut again in half so that I have 24 pieces out of the dish, or you can even cut it into 32 pieces. You can decide depending on what other food you're serving with it. And it's just great. Bake it in the oven at 375 for about 50 minutes or until golden brown. And that is it. Ready to go. It's delicious. Everybody will love it. And let me know what you think. So anyway, now I'd love to invite on Carlene Madigan. She is an editor at The Story Publishing. And before becoming an editor at Story Publishing, Carlene was the managing editor of a horticulture magazine and lived on an organic farm outside of Boston, Massachusetts. And that's where she first learned her homesteading skills that she talks about in her book, The Backyard Homestead. And in this book, she can show you, she, you know, clearly lays out how you can grow all the food you need on just a quarter acre. And it's really an amazing book. Carlene, are you with us?
I am. Thanks so much for having me on, Bhavani.
Thank you. And thank you so much for sending this book to me as quickly as you did. It's just so great. And I'm really glad I had a chance to look it over before you joined me on the show.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Yeah, it's really great. You know, and it has these charts in here that are just so needed. I know that I'm always wondering, you know, and you don't want to look at each little package of seeds that you have. So it's so nice to have it all together, you know, how many seeds, you know, in a 50-foot row and the distance between and how much should you plant, you know, if you have a family of four. You know, those kind of, you know, basic things that people just don't know who didn't grow up on a farm.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that was, I'm a big fan of charts to begin with, so you'll find good charts all throughout the book. But yeah, I mean, part of my reason for wanting to put this together was the sense that people had kind of, you know, lost touch with all of these traditional skills and, you know, specifically with the source of their food, and that there was this growing eagerness to reconnect with the source of their food. And so having this kind of a survey of information, which, by the way, is all material that is reprinted from other story books that we've published through the years, with a little bit of, you know, my writing kind of tying things together. You know, to kind of bring together this survey of information for people who are really just getting started and don't have a lot of, you know, context and just want to see what's out there.
Mm-hmm. And when you, on your chart, your garden planning chart, when you talk about distance between rows, is that for the intensive planting that you're doing on a quarter acre?
Generally, in these kinds of charts, the planting spacing is to be able to give the plant enough room to grow. Often with beginning gardeners especially, they try and pack in too many plants into too small of a space. So we found that by providing this kind of information, it gives you a better sense of how much you can plant in a given space. It's to help you plan your space better.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what inspired you to become a backyard gardener?
Well, you know, it's funny looking back over the years. I guess I've always had some kind of garden. Actually, I've moved around so much and had multiple gardens.
Where are you originally from?
Oh, I grew up mostly in California.
Mm-hmm.
But even just in my adult life, I was counting back, and I think over 10 or 12 years, I started 9 different gardens. So I kind of started one wherever I went, and mostly because I was at Horticulture Magazine, I was mostly engrossed in ornamental plants for a long time, was always on a farm or near a farm where I could buy vegetables. And it was really, you know, over the last, oh, I don't know, really since coming to Story, that I got more interested in growing vegetables for myself.
Mm-hmm.
So I've really been learning a lot from that process and also just from all of the authors that I work with.
Mm-hmm. So Story publishing mostly books on gardening and, you know, environmental stuff?
Yes. Stories focuses books for self-sufficiency. And so we do gardening, we do cooking, small farming, crafting. We have a variety of different books, animal care.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but all with the focus of helping people find the information they need to provide for themselves.
Cool. That's great. So how would you describe the backyard garden? Why don't you describe what you do?
what I do personally in my garden?
Yeah, what you do personally in your garden and more also just the trend of backyard gardening. I mean, it's really becoming so much more popular. I mean, people who you would have never thought would have been gardening are now gardening. It's kind of taking off, it seems to me.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think that there's a huge revival in not just gardening, but all kinds of traditional crafts. So, you know, beer brewing, keeping bees, you know, artisanal bread making, all of these areas we've seen have a huge increase in interest over the last few years. And, you know, specifically in gardening, I think that there's people definitely have, you know, for one, a concern about where their food is coming from and what's in it. You're kind of seeing also a little, I think they call it the baby boomlet, mm-hmm. you know, people having a lot of kids and wanting to spend time with their kids outside and show them where their food comes from. So that's another part of it. But also, you know, food prices just have been rising so much every year. And, you know, it's not something that is going to go away. I think organic food in particular is expensive to produce. And if you want farmers to have to be able to have a livelihood, it almost needs to be expensive. And I think that a lot of people, as an alternative to buying food from small farmers, have started growing it themselves because it's just so much less expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really amazing. Once you get started, it's amazing how much food you can grow on a pretty small piece of land. So,
yeah, one thing I keep hearing from people, and I know personally just how much time it takes. Do you have any tricks for trying to balance how much time it takes and, you know, making the most of one's time so that it is manageable?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that it's always good to try and minimize the labor, but to also keep in mind that a garden is a garden because of the human element, because you're interacting with the land. So that, you know, that is what makes it a garden. Otherwise, it would just be wild.
Right.
So I try and, you know, remind people of that. But definitely, you know, I have a rather large garden, and for me, this time of year, you know, the weeds get out of hand. And
I mean, I love my time in the garden. It's meditative. But it's still, you know, if you don't get out there for a couple of days, it's like, uh-oh.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And for me, the big key has been mulching really, really well, because the thing that I think gets out of hand for people are the weeds. So putting down, you know, especially in the pathways, a layer of cardboard or newspaper. I'm known as the cardboard hoarder in the office here. Take cardboard home and put it down in the garden in the pathways and, you know, put straw mulch on top of that. That goes a long way toward keeping the weeds down, but also, you know, retaining a lot of the soil, moisture in the soil. So that's definitely one good trick. And also to pick frequently, you know, to not let the harvest get out of hand when it's really coming on strong, especially this time of year, to get out there and pick squashes, summer squashes, when they're really small. You know, go out every day and pick something.
Isn't it amazing how much they can grow overnight?
Yeah, it's freaking
you know,
me out.
And then, you know, you just think, oh, I'll get it tomorrow, and then one day you might not get there, and the next day you come and you have like a baseball bat.
Yeah, exactly. And they're sneaky too. They hide from you under those big leaves.
Right, so. Right. You know what, I had squash bug this year. First time I ever had that.
Yeah, me too. It was the first time.
Really?
And I lost pretty much, yeah, all of my winter squash is gone because I, you know, went away on vacation and came back. And I was like, huh, all right then. I guess there's no winter squash there this year.
Uh-huh.
So it's a little scary.
Yeah, it's amazing you know, how vulnerable you become, you know, and it's, you know, and you know, I heard that, you know, a friend of mine who's been farming forever said, you know, they one row they planted and just didn't come up. And I thought, you know, as a beginning gardener, even though I've been doing it for, you know, 5 years, I still certainly consider myself a beginning gardener, you know, because I'm experiencing things for the first time all the time. And not that it's, you know, not that misery loves comfort, but somewhere, you know, it's like when you realize that, you know, experienced gardeners experience that too. It's not just, you know, me as a beginning gardener, I got squash bug. It's like squash bug can be everywhere.
Yeah, and I think the more familiar you become with particular crops, the more kind of tips and tricks you learn. And it's a lot like with cooking, they say, if you focus on one ingredient or, you know, one kind of food and learn all the different ways to deal with it, you know, spend a month just cooking chicken 90 different ways. It's the same with growing crops. You know, if you just focus on squash and grow a number of different varieties and learn what the pests are and how to deal with them, you kind of hone your skills and your abilities so that you know next year, you know, what's a better way to go about this. So for me, you know, next year, because after I got the squash bugs and the squash vine borers, I seem to have both of them, I looked that up, and, you know, one of the best ways to avoid getting it is just to plant late, to plant a month late, so that you actually miss their life cycle, or they find other people's squash plants to go after instead of yours.
Oh, really? I didn't get that.
Yeah, and, you know, with summer squash this year, one of the things I've noticed, I planted both Zephyr, which is a yellow squash with a little green tip at the end, and black zucchini squash. And apparently, black zucchini squash is one of the worst for getting powdery mildew, which is a kind of fungus.
Right.
And so, after looking that up, and actually I looked up powdery mildew, and it said the black variety of zucchini is the worst for this. And I said, oh, great, I'm so glad I planted that. But the Zephyr is perfectly clean. And so next year I'm thinking, well, maybe I just plant Zephyr next year and find other kind of tolerant varieties.
Right.
So those are kind of two big things I learned this year from my garden.
Isn't it great that we, you know, still can learn? Anyway, let's take just a couple-minute break, Carlene, and when we come back, I want to hear more about your book and some of the other projects you're working on.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Okay. Hello, everyone, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And my guest today is Carlene Madigan, who is the author of The Backyard Homestead, where you can produce all the food you need in just a quarter acre. Carlene, are you with me?
I am. Thanks.
Thank you. So in your book, you talk about succession planting, which is something that I am, you know, always, not, I won't say struggling with, but, you know, really trying to get that rhythm down of, like, what, you know, when to take something else up and when to put something else down. And I don't know if you heard my opening, you know, I was trying to, trying in anticipation of harvesting some things and knowing space is going to be opening up. I started another round of lettuce early. And I killed it. I left it in the greenhouse Sunday, and I came back Monday morning, and there was nothing there.
Oh, no.
They just kind of, like, fell over, and I tried to revive them, but they didn't want any part of it.
Oh.
So I'll start again. But when you do the succession, you talk about turning everything over and putting, you know, the incorporating any remaining plant material into the soil. Do you recommend doing that as opposed to the no-till? Like, you don't worry about disrupting the little animals that are living under the soil?
Well, it depends to some degree on what it is that you're planting. Also, you know, because this book is drawn from material from a number of different storybooks, Every author has their own technique for how to grow things, so that makes a difference also. Certainly in my own garden, I do try and disturb the soil as little as possible. I do mostly, raised bed gardening. When you're... the only thing to be careful about with leaving plant material behind is if there are any insects attached to it. You know, if you have a diseased plant or something that is being infested, like with our squash vine borers, you wouldn't want to leave that behind.
Right.
You want to get that out of there.
I didn't even put that in my compost. I actually put it in my garbage.
Yeah, I'm going to burn it.
Right.
So that is one thing to be careful about. But certainly, with peas and beans, I would just till those right into the soil. Or till does not have to mean getting out a rototiller and tilling, but just kind of forking it into the soil to let it decompose while the soil is resting. And it is a good idea to give the soil a chance to rest between crops. Using a good cover crop is a good idea, too, if your soil's going to be fallow for any, long period of time.
Like when you say resting, are you talking about resting, like, for the rest of the season? Are you talking about resting, like, for a week?
Well, again, it depends on what you've planted there and how many nutrients you've taken out of the soil. With lettuce, I mean, I pretty much just continually plant lettuce in the same spot, and that seems to be okay.
Right, for the whole season.
Yeah, yeah. And, I'll take up part of a bed with a seeding 1 week, and then 2 weeks later do another seeding in another part of the bed and just kind of keep it rolling. But, with something like corn or other plants that take a lot out of the soil, it's a good idea to, once it's harvested, put down a cover crop that's going to stay there over the winter, until the next spring, both to kind of retain the soil itself to keep it from, blowing away, really, but also to kind of return some nutrients to the soil.
Mm-hmm. What do you use for cover crop? It's one thing when I think of cover crops, I'm thinking of these farmers that have acres and acres, When you're dealing with a little quarter acre, you're doing cover crop on just a few little rows, right?
Yeah. Buckwheat is a really good one. Depending, again, on what you're growing, if you harvest a whole bed of something and you know you're not going to be planting, I mean, it's fine to put a cover crop just in that one bed, My beds are 4x6, and I would put buckwheat in the whole bed and just let it sit there.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when it's helpful to have more space and to always have something be producing and have another part be fallow.
Mm-hmm. Have you found that by gardening you have been able to kind of create a different type of community around you through the gardening?
I feel like, by gardening and just having that to kind of talk with people when I go down to the general store in our town, I'm not making the community, but I'm becoming a part of the community that's already there. I live in this amazing place where pretty much everybody has a garden, or, a good chunk of the population has a big vegetable garden and animals and, fruit trees. So it's definitely fun to go hang out at the store and, chat with people about what they're growing and what problems they've had this season and how they're dealing with them. That's the best way to learn.
Yeah. I guess I wasn't meaning so much as creating a community, but I live in suburbia, and I would think a lot of people who are talking about quarter-acre homesteading are also in a suburban-type setting. And, so often we all live in these little isolated lives, and you don't venture out much, or you drive most places, and there's not that much walking to places, and I've just found that by having a garden, as you said, it's a talking point with people, but it's also just kind of makes the community that exists a little bit stronger. It makes connections amongst people that didn't exist before, you know, and also crosses different generations. And I don't know, I have found gardening, as I've watched it expand here on Long Island, become an opportunity for building stronger community.
Yeah, no, I think that's definitely the case, especially in suburban areas where you have a lot of people. We have sidewalks, you have people walking by, especially if you like to plant in your front yard, which I think is a great idea. And I was up visiting Roger Dwaran, who is the founder of Kitchen Gardeners International.
He was a guest a few weeks ago.
Oh, great. Oh, that's wonderful. And he, you know, his main garden is out back, but he does always keep a small vegetable garden out front just, you know, for that very reason, to kind of attract people who are passing by and to get them talking about, you know, what he's growing and why he's doing this. And it's just a conversation starter. So I think the more visible your garden is, the better. It encourages other people to give it a try.
And where would you advise people to begin if they wanted to start a backyard garden?
I would start with one bed. One bed or just one container. I mean, the one thing that I know a lot of people do, and actually friends that I have who used to have more land for gardening and now really can just have a couple of containers, to just do a, two self-watering containers, pick your favorite tomato variety and, some greens, maybe a pepper plant, and just plant those two containers. The self-watering containers are great because I also know a number of people who try growing in containers every year, and it's just so hard to keep up with the watering. And the self-watering containers make it really easy, especially for big plants like tomatoes that just need so much water.
What is a self-watering container? I don't even know.
They're kind of becoming more and more available. I mean, you can get them at big box stores now. I think they originated with the Gardner Supply Company, and I think Gardner Supply still sells the best variety, or the highest quality materials, really. But it's a system where it's kind of a container within a container. So there's a reservoir. And you fill up the reservoir with, say, I think it's 5 gallons of water, 10 gallons of water. And that's kind of constantly wicking up into the soil. So the soil is in a container that is, just connected to the water by a couple of channels that wick the water up into the soil. So the plant is getting a constant supply of moisture that way. And I was, the first time I heard about them, I was a little skeptical, but I tell you, they work pretty well.
Really?
So if you're gardening in containers, it's definitely a good way to go.
Well, that's nice. It actually sounds like something I should get for my in-laws.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
You know, they're getting older, and it'd just be nice to have that. I love the sound of it.
Yeah.
That's definitely, as you said before, you're gardening because of the human element, and you want to get out there.
Mm-hmm.
But, sometimes, life, it just, keeps you from getting out there.
It's true. And some things that you want to be paying attention to a lot and some things you don't want to be paying attention to a lot. One of my authors is Ed Smith, who wrote the Vegetable Gardener's Bible. And he and his wife, Sylvia, have a whole self-watering container garden, even though they have a giant, high-production vegetable garden, just because there are some things they found that grow better in these containers than they do in the ground even. And especially because they're in Vermont, things like eggplant and peppers, which, it's hard to get the soil warm enough for those to be happy. They love the containers. It's great.
That's good.
Good idea.
Do you do anything to extend your season?
I do, actually. This year, I've used row covers. I tend to leave a few things standing in the garden. You know, kale gets by pretty well with a few frosts. But this year, I'm getting a hoop house or polytunnel.
You are.
So that I can have greens through the winter, which I'm very excited about.
Uh-huh.
Actually, one of the books that I worked on recently, which came out, I think this January or last December, is called The Year-Round Vegetable Gardener. And the author is Nikki Jabor, and she lives in Nova Scotia. And she, using actually just little hoop houses that she's made herself out of bending PVC pipes over the bed and covering them just with clear plastic that you would get at the hardware store. She's able to keep kale going and spinach. She has a few cold frames where she does arugula and mosh. Carrots. She does carrots just by packing leaf mulch over the top of the carrot patch and putting a bit of row cover on top of that, or any kind of cloth to keep the ground from freezing solid, and pulls that back and is able to dig up carrots for a good chunk of the winter.
Wow.
So it's that book, more than anything, I think has inspired me over the last year, because I find myself in January and February just wanting a fresh salad,
Right.
So I'm really looking forward to that this winter.
Right. Well, I got a little greenhouse. It's not very big, but I got a little greenhouse this year. It's plastic, but I put it up, and I got it up a little too late to really help me get my garden in early.
Mm-hmm.
But I am hoping I can, maybe do some potted plants, containers, out there in the winter, and get it going. But I'm going to look into the hoop tunnels. It's a great idea for extending it, because I know what you mean, wanting those greens.
Yeah, yeah.
So what are your favorite tools in the garden? What tool do you find most useful when you're out there?
I use relatively few tools, other than just having a basic shovel and a rake, a set of pruners, just, hand pruners. I guess the thing that I use the most is, it's called a digging knife. It's kind of a cross between a trowel and a knife. It has a serrated edge. And, I use that for everything. I mean, for digging up just a couple of potatoes, or weeding. It's great for weeding, really getting the roots out of things. So I'd say that's probably the one thing that I use the most. And I also have an authentic English wooden harvest trug, which I just love. Actually, I have a couple of them, and those are my favorite things to harvest into. So.
What is, say that again?
It's called a wooden trug. It's a harvest basket that's made out of split ash or willow. And it's just beautiful, and it wears really well. And I think people kind of forget to incorporate the aesthetics into the garden also. You want to have fun and enjoy being out there. So you should have a few things that you like having around just because you like the way they look.
Uh-huh. Now, what I planted in my garden, I mean, it's mostly vegetables. But I planted a couple years ago gladiolus.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And they keep coming back every year, and they're so beautiful. And, they actually grow so tall that they start to fall over, so then you don't feel bad cutting them.
Yeah, yeah.
And they last so long indoors.
Yeah, they really do.
So I'm still getting flowers out of the gladiolus, and that's been really fun.
Yeah, my favorite gladiolus is this one called, I think it's an Abyssinian gladiolus, and it's just a small white flower with a kind of deep ruby throat, and it's fragrant, and it lasts for about 2 weeks in the vase. It's amazing.
Right, and it starts, when it does start going bad, it starts at the bottom, so you can just take the little bottom ones off.
Yeah, yeah.
And the top still looks brand new. Wonderful. Yeah. Wonderful. So do you do anything like strawberries, you know, the type of vegetables where you, or fruits where you keep them in the same spot year after year? Asparagus?
I do. I have asparagus. I have, I planted, last year, I guess I planted about 60 strawberry plants. I have about 25 raspberry plants and only 6 blueberries, but maybe I'll get a couple more. You know, some rhubarb, a lot of herbs. Ironically, I find that I don't use most of the herbs I have, but I kind of just like having them around.
So it's fun.
Yeah. The herb that I've been enjoying the most actually having fresh is bay leaves. It's not hardy for us here, but a friend of mine, a fellow gardener, gave me a plant that she's been growing for the last 30 years, planting it in the ground every summer and then bringing it indoors. And I've just kind of kept it indoors until recently. And it's beautiful. It's huge. And bay leaves taste amazingly different fresh than they do dried. You buy those dry things in the grocery store.
Right. I've
been sitting around for how long, you know?
Uh-huh.
So that's been my favorite thing this year.
And what do you do with bay leaves, fresh bay leaves?
I mean, I put them in just about everything. A lot of Indian food, mac and cheese, you know, having a couple of bay leaves in there seems to add a lot of flavor. Tomato sauce.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any experience with peach trees? I don't know if you've heard my saga with my peach tree.
I seem to
have
no.
a boar in my peach tree. And it's like crying, you know. It's like oozing sap from the branches.
Plum curculio, is it that guy?
I don't know what it is, but it's just killing me. Experience with that?
I have not grown peach trees because I know that they're so difficult.
Uh-huh.
And I have a great orchard that I go to, and I'm happy to give them my peach business. But I know that there is, there's at least one book out. We have a book called The Fruit Bible, which is a great book, or The Fruit Gardener's Bible, which has a number of different ideas in it for how to deal with that. There's also another book that I think is mostly about apple trees, but he may also deal with peach trees. It's called The Holistic Orchard by Michael Phillips. And that's a very good book, too.
And are all the books that you sell, it all promotes organic, does it not?
Right. We have that as our focus, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Great. So if people want to purchase your book, The Backyard Homestead, how would they do that?
Well, you can buy it just about anywhere on Amazon. Or I actually, you know, encourage people to go to their local bookstore to buy it.
Mm-hmm.
So keep those bookstores in business.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Was there any other tips that you'd like to share with people listening before we run out of time? We have just a couple more minutes.
I'm all for people getting out into the garden and trying new things. Once you get beyond that stage of just planting one or two tomato plants, try a lot of different varieties and see what happens. And don't be afraid when things fail or when something gets eaten or the bugs come after you. You know, it's all okay. It doesn't matter. People have this insane fear of killing plants, but I have one gardener, told me that's how you measure success is by how many plants you've killed. And it's really true. You have to be okay with things not going well and to just kind of
go with the flow. Yeah, that's what I was just talking about before when I said, I came out and I had killed all those seedlings. You feel bad for a moment, but you just get up again and do it again.
Oh, yeah. There are always more seeds in the world, It's
so true.
So try something new and don't be afraid to fail.
Thank you, Carlene. That's a great, great way to end the show because everyone has to get out there and just do it. And,
yeah.
Fear is the last thing you want to hold you back.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
I hope our paths cross again. And I will enjoy this book thoroughly. Thank you so much.
Great. Thanks, Bhavani.
Everyone out there who's been listening, thank you for joining us. I look forward to seeing you all next week or being with you all next week. And if you're interested in any of those cooking classes, I'd love to see you at my homestead. And you can go out into my garden and harvest some of the vegetables yourself. Anyway, I'll see you all next week. Have a great one. Bye now.